Hi there, fellow ocean enthusiast. My name's Lauren, and I'm a second year marine biology and coastal ecology student at Plymouth University. And this is Plymouth Beneath the Surface. Throughout history, Plymouth has been well known as being the starting point for many famous voyages and discoveries, and acted as a honeypot to marine biologists from around the world. Come on board with me and meet people from Plymouth that have orientated their lives around the ocean. Scientists, divers, photographers, students, NGO members, artists, and many more. Learn about the ocean, discuss current topics, local conservation initiatives, and find out why Plymouth really is the best place in the world to study and work in the field of marine biology. Hi Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. So we're just going to start by... Can you briefly introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. My name's Matt Bell. I'm a second year marine biology and oceanography student here at Plymouth University. And I'm honoured to be a guest on the podcast for Plymouth Beneath the Surface.
Thank you very much. Love to hear it. I've heard that you were an avid listener of season one.
Yeah, definitely. Louise, putting it out there.
Yeah. Big shout out to Louise, who's somewhere in the ocean on a boat. So, first question, everyone on our course came to Plymouth and decided to study marine biology for slightly different reasons. What was yours?
That's a good question. What was my reason for coming to Plymouth University? I guess I can break that down into several aspects. One, it's Plymouth University. It's known for its marine scientists. If you want to come to Plymouth to study a marine-related degree, then you've got amazing professors that are always there for you. You've got the HSE course, which is one of the main reasons, might I add, for coming to Plymouth University. The HSE course and the scientific diving module that I offer are the only university that offer that in the whole of the UK. So that was my main reason for coming here. But the lecturers themselves are all at the top of the game, are all conducting research, and they're just really helpful. What I found particularly interesting about Plymouth University was on the open day. When I went to all the other open days, for example, Southampton, which was the other university I was thinking about, Newcastle University, they didn't have the lecturers there speaking. But when I came to Plymouth University, the lecturers were there. They were engaging with us. They were speaking to us. They wanted us to come. They were passionate about the subject that they were talking about, and that was very evident. And so that was something that drew me to go, Plymouth University is the university to be at.
No, that is very true. I remember actually, I didn't go to an open day, but I came to an applicant day because I was pretty sure anyway that I wanted to go to Plymouth. And I saw Mark Briffer, and we went and we were looking at things in the tank, and it was just, his passion was just there. You could see it, and you know what Mark's like anyway. So you did the scientific diving module last year, and you also did the HSE during the summer. And yeah, how did you find that for people that might be considering doing it?
Well, there's not really a bad word I can say about it, to be honest. I mean, that was one of the main reasons why I came to Plymouth University, was to do the HSE course, was to do the scientific diving module. And actually, fingers crossed at that point, that maybe I'd be able to do the internship after I heard about that. And you know, sitting here today, I've managed to do my HSE course, I've managed to do the scientific diving module, and now I've been selected to do the internship, one of two people, for June and July of this academic year. It's absolutely fantastic. I've been diving since age 12. I got my open water diving qualification when I was just on holiday by accident. I thought this looks interesting, and I was hooked from the second. I guess that was a given that I'm studying marine biology and oceanography, but there you go.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to expand my career, basically, in the diving world, because it really is another universe, right? Forget space. Who cares about space for now? But the ocean, it's something where accessible that everyone can get to and everyone can learn from. And diving is really a window into that world and helps with your science that's going on at the moment, with your data collection. For example, in our OS207, the scientific diving module, we were diving every single week for our coursework to collect the data to do transects underwater. When you're doing biology or some of your other subjects, perhaps at university, you're doing transects, you're using quadrats. Well, we're using all of that and learning how to take photos, but under the water. that just adds an extra dimension to the whole thing and makes it so much more worthwhile. And I guess it's in line with the Sustainable Development Goal 14, right? Life Below the Waters. That module, along with OS201, where we collected our own data on the boats, sort of links to the Life Below Water Sustainable Development Goals 14, because it's teaching us as undergraduates within the higher education the skills appropriate and teaching us what's needed to then educate others, but also to teach ourselves how to conduct good science relative to that UN goal of our planet's betterment.
No, amazing. And that's what you're doing. You are teaching this summer, am I right? So I'm on the HSE course and you're going to be teaching me, I'm hoping?
Not quite teaching. I'm not a teacher on that front, but I'll be helping make the course run smoothly as the intern there.
Yeah.
I'll be driving the pigs, as they call them, so that's the power boats.
The pigs? What's the thing behind that? I don't...
It's just a rib, it's a power boat, but it's called pig.
Okay,
So I'll be driving those around for you all. Fingers crossed I don't crash. I've got my power boating course coming up later. They've put me through a whole load of courses to make sure I'm correctly qualified to help you guys on the course, which is really, really helpful. That's one of the benefits, by the way, if you're applying to do the scientific, the HSE course as the internship. They teach you, if you haven't got it already, VHF radio, power boating level 2, sea survival. And the university pays for that all, but during the internship you don't get paid. But that's basically your pay, is how I'm seeing it. And you get qualifications out of it, which is fantastic.
I was going to say, it's a win-win, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah.
So what dives kind of have stood out for you?
There's ones that stand out for different reasons. I guess a recent one would be during the scientific diving module, when we were putting everything that we learned together for our coursework. You know, I was actually doing science. That's meaningful because it's my coursework. It's teaching me how to do things. And so in that manner of speaking, those dives, those commercial dives, where we're conducting scientific research for our coursework or for whatever it might be, are really rewarding and quite fulfilling because you're doing something for a purpose. It's not just looking and seeing something, which is also fantastic. So that dive for me was... or all those dives, really, especially when you've got good visibility. By the way, when I mean good visibility for the UK, I mean it's a fantastic day if you get about 5 metres of visibility. Some of the dives, which are evident by some of the photos, you'd be very lucky to get, you know, half a metre sometimes. So that was the most, in terms of rewarding dives, that was the most rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the most, this is a really fantastic and enjoyable experience, that would probably be when I was in Malta, because that's when I was diving with my entire family, plus family friends, because I got my qualification first in the world of diving. And so that was the first family holiday that we had in Malta, that we were diving as a group together. Which was really nice because it means the whole family could go rather than just me and they'd be off doing something else. So we felt as one unit, basically, a team.
Yeah.
And the most memorable dive I think it was when I was doing my advanced. It was a night dive. So my first official night dive, because I've done night dives before that, was when I saw a sleeping turtle, and we decided, or rather my instructor decided, he was going to chase after a shark in the middle of the night dive. So that was interesting. Black-tipped reef shark. So yeah, and I guess a day dive, that would be when I was in Indonesia and we decided, let's go somewhere new. And I was with my dive master and we sort of went, this looks like a place that might be good. And so we went there and we discovered a new coral reef. And so that was absolutely fantastic. And I got to name that. And
what did
I called
you call
it? Salad reef. It wasn't very Indonesian.
Salad reef?
But, well, it looked like a salad bowl if you have a look at it today.
Okay.
And so that's what I named it. And as a, you know, a 14-year-old... I'm sure you could have come up with better names, to be honest. That was pretty bad on my part.
I was going to say, you had a go. What would you call it now if you had a second chance, out of curiosity? Not to put you
on
the spot.
Well, to be fair, the second coral reef that I did find the next day, out of all places, I called that Batu Kapau, which is more fitting for the area where I was because it was in the local dialect, although the meaning behind that escapes me at the moment. But there we are. It's more in line with the area, which is, I guess, better.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go and research that now so we knew what you called it. Obviously, you're a second year, I'm a second year, and our studies have been impacted by COVID. And I just wondered kind of what we're doing during lockdown. So we did our degree. Did you do anything extra to kind of supplement your degree? Because we couldn't do field work, we couldn't go diving. What sort of things were you doing to kind of keep yourself...
Oh, I wish I was that interesting. Well, during lockdown, what did I do? That's when I got involved with the Ice Warrior project. It was the lockdown period. I was in a studio flat on my own. I thought, well, I'm a member of the MBA. So I might as well go along to one of their talks, given that, you know, I'm a member. Very, you know, fateful that day would be, is I'd attend this talk, and well, I decided, because it was also about the Arctic and that's what I'm interested in. It was actually by some Russian scientists talking about the permafrost melting and how that can release, you know, all the bacteria that have been stored within that area. And also looking back at Antarctica. And it was the 15 minutes at the end. It wasn't a long time. It was 15 minutes at the end. This explorer called Jim McNeil came on to the MBA and did his Zoom at the end, talking about what he was doing, talking about his projects, what he'd done in the past, and what he was trying to achieve, that being the hashtag Last Polar Expedition. And I thought, as a first-year marine biology and oceanography student, that's absolutely fantastic. You know, it's getting citizen science involved. You don't need to have any previous experience. And I thought, you know what? I'll just send off an email and I'll see what happens. So I sent Jim off an email, and Sam responded, because she does all the emailing side of things.
Yeah.
And she said, basically, why don't you come along to a selection weekend and we can take it from there? And I thought, okay, let's do a selection weekend then. So selection happened in September of 2021. Right. And it kind of just went on from there. I can't say very much about selection weekend because that's a secret. So went from there, did selection weekend, and then they said, why don't you come back for core skills, which is 10 days, learning advanced first aid for the first four of those, and then all the other skills afterwards. You can see what I've been doing in some photos if you follow my Ice Warrior Matt Instagram page, or Twitter or Facebook page. It's all on there for you to see. So that was one, basically, seminar talk that I attended during that period of time that ended in this position of I'm now training to go to the Arctic, to the Northern Polar of Inaccessibility, which is absolutely fantastic. Other things that I did during that time period was cycling, running, did a lot of that, just speaking to friends, I guess. Nothing too extraordinary or out of, you know, in the extremes. I just sort of, as everyone, I think, at that time period, trying to survive, trying to get through first year of university, given that it was all on Zoom. You know, we hadn't had proper A levels. It'd been really bizarre summer period. So it was also trying to get back up to actually, oh, yeah, I need to do stuff.
So how come no one's ever been to the Northern Pole of Inaccessibility before then?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I was also thinking the same thing as well. I guess it's worth remembering there are four poles, both in the north and the south. The one that the expedition hashtag last pole is going to is the Northern Pole of Inaccessibility. And the inaccessible bit comes because it's the farthest point away in all directions from land. So hence the furthest point away. If you do a triangulation, it's basically the centre of the Arctic Ocean. So that's where we're trying to get to. Why has no one ever been there before? The late British explorer, Wally Hubert, in 1968, whilst en route to the geographic North Pole, so again, one of the other poles, on his dog sled, went through the Northern Pole of Inaccessibility. But Matt, you've just said he's been through the Northern Pole of Inaccessibility. However, there's conflicting evidence about the location of this pole. Jim McNeil initiated an investigation that involved Bob Headland and Gareth Rees of Cambridge University, and provided that the location we all believed was the correct location was in fact wrong. Wrong by 214 kilometres. The new site was plotted by NASA satellites imagery in the Arctic by Ted Scrumbles of the National Snow and Ice Data Centre. His colleagues published this finding online in August in the journal Polar Records in 2014. The reasons for the error are still unknown. The discovery of the Endurance couldn't have come at a better time. The expedition hashtag last pole that we're embarking on is the last expedition unfulfilled by Sir Ernest Shackleton. So the discovery of the Endurance at the time at which it came about is very good publicity in one way to the expedition that we're undertaking. The expedition is set to in the style of Sir Ernest Shackleton's expeditions, and I think it's a good sign that we ended up finding his ship.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good omen.
A good omen, indeed.
How are you travelling? Are you walking, skiing,
sledding? So we are skiing.
Skiing?
Nordic skiing. 10 hours a day, carrying our own body weight behind us in a pulk or kajak, which is the Inuit term. So that's what's happening. 10 hours a day, skiing across the pole. Although it'll be flat, so hopefully, well, I'm hoping it'll be flat. If it's not flat, then we're probably in the wrong place. but still very taxing, given the extreme conditions and where we actually are.
How are you sitting here so calm when you're telling me all of this? Because it must be quite nerve-wracking. Like, I can't fathom how you're going somewhere that no one else has ever been before. That's just crazy. How are you coping?
Through proper training and determination. To be honest, there's a lot of things that are on my mind at the moment, so that I don't need to think too much. I mean, always, you know, I'm going to go through all this training by the time I come to doing the actual expedition. The worst case scenarios I've been prepped for and trained for, so I'm not too concerned about that. Before the podcast, you asked me, and other people have as well, what are you most scared about happening? And usually everyone goes, or presumes rather, it'll be the polar bears. That's going to be the most scary thing, right? If you're going on an expedition, collecting all these crucial data sets for the NASA-funded National Snow and Ice Data Center, for the MBA, who gave me the travel award grant to do my polar training.
Can I just ask quickly, what do they do with that data? Once you've collected it, so, yeah, what happens next?
Yeah, so basically, once that data has been collected, it'll be used to model sea ice growth and decay models. It'll be used to compare the new satellites that NASA have put out, so the ICSEAT satellites, which are there to create a new degree of accuracy. But we need a way of validating them, right? And so the best way to do that is having someone on the ground to say what this satellite is collecting is actually correct. Because there's loads of parameters in there that might skew the data or might make the satellite misjudge on the thickness of, for example, the sea ice, because the layer of snow above it can mess with the optics of everything, potentially. Okay. They just want to make sure, as any good science, is what they're collecting, is it actually correct? It needs validating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that so makes that's one sense. Of the main purposes of the goals. And that's under the Nobel Prize winning scientist, Dr. Walt Meyer, who we're doing that for. So again, there is massive scientific significance in what we are doing. I don't think I would have partook in this expedition if there wasn't a science core to it, because I speak to Jim and he is an explorer. Yes, that is in his name. But exploring these days isn't, I'm going to go out there and find this place, because we've got satellites that do that. We're not going out there to map it anymore. So in the Edwardian sense of the term of an explorer goes and maps new places, it's kind of a little bit redundant in certain areas because we've got satellites that do that. Technology's advanced to that point at which, okay, we can go and explore somewhere, but we can't say we've gone and mapped it and, you know, added it to a map, because that's already been done. But what we're doing is scientific exploration, I guess you could call it.
Yep.
You know, we're going out there, we're doing an 800 mile transect, you know, from our drop-off point as the crow flies, 800 miles to the northern pole of inaccessibility, which is split into 20 days, so roughly 200 miles for each core group that's going with Jim, supporting him on this expedition. So what drove me to join this was the scientific nature of it.
Yeah,
you know, it's a bit of citizen science. Yeah. There's a big risk, you know. I don't want to lose my life or a limb or what have you. I'm not, you know, I'm going for the proper training. That's not going to happen. But of course, there's always a possibility for all of that.
Okay. You're not just going for a jolly and for a kick almost. It is for the data and the wider implications of that data.
Yeah, it's global, right? There's a global significance to everything that's going on, right? The polar regions are the alarm bells, and they have been for the last 60 years for climate change, you know. Are we going to get constant catastrophic weather, you know, in the future? Well, we can turn to the extreme areas such as the Arctic to actually determine that, because where is that going to happen first? It's going to happen in those extreme locations. And from that, we can model what's actually going to happen. And so that's a big reason. Also, you look at the poles and they have massive significance to the circulation system, right, in the oceans. And, you know, dense water sinks, right, which then drives the rest of the whole current system around the world. So, you know, if these ice caps melt, what's going to happen? So there's actually really significant commercial, economic importance in what we're actually doing, in what we're actually collecting.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have massive impacts, for example, on a growing market, aquaculture, the fish industry. What's going to happen to all those species that like to live in the cold water, all those ones in the North Sea, or further up in the polar regions? It's going to open up new shipping channels. you know, to cross that region, which couldn't be crossed previously, which means there's going to be new resources to be captured, right? So Russia, for example, is interested. America is interested, all in the oil reserves that are up there. Of course, we're trying to move away from that, mm-hmm. as seen with COP26, although, you know, that's another measurement, is actually what we're implementing in that going to actually occur. So these are all really big questions that are hopefully going to be answered through the data that we're collecting on this expedition.
It's kind of mind-blowing that you are actually going to have a part in that, like 50 years' time, whenever you'll be able to say, okay, yeah, I helped with that a little bit. It's so amazing. Not everyone can say that they've taken part in something so crucial, really.
Hmm.
So back to what you were most scared of, we kind of went on a tangent.
Yeah, I veered off from that. Sorry, no,
that was my fault.
What I'm saying is polar bears, yes, they're scary, but they're not what I'm most scared about. What I'm most scared about is when you're in your tent, you've had your however many days it might have been a walking, you're absolutely exhausted, you've just come off polar bear watch, someone else has taken your shift for you, you get into your sleeping bag, you've just fallen asleep, and all of a sudden you get woken up by the big cracking sound of the ice breaking beneath you, and you've got to get out, because otherwise you're going to be submerged in this freezing water.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone wants that, especially if you've just gotten asleep, right?
No.
And the ice is all on the same field, like a table, for example, and you're camped on that table. If the table decides to break and the water comes flooding in, that's a flat surface. So that water's going to be coming at you pretty quickly. So you're not going to have very long to get out your sleeping bag, make sure everything's packed away and get straight on it, you know? That's what I'm most worried about, just the getting up and moving on, the shock, I guess, of that whole period. Because polar bears is fine, we can deal with them, they're hopefully not going to get that close to us. We know we have ways of making sure they'd stop tracking us, for example,
yeah.
to making sure that we're safe should we encounter a polar bear. We're a team and we'll work as a team, and that'll be for every situation. But personally, what I'm most feared about is that point at which I'm fast asleep and we get woken up, the ice is breaking, we need to get out of here now, because that just sounds like not a very pleasant experience.
It's definitely worse than an alarm going off in the morning, that's for sure.
Certainly get you up in the morning.
Yeah, the ice cracking around you. It sounds like a horror film. So you say you're trained to deal with that, but how are you trained to deal with that when you're training on Dartmoor, right? There's no ice there. How do you learn that without actually being there?
So in this May, I'm going to Svalbard, which is within the polar circle. It's a part of Norway. It's a group of islands at the top.
Okay.
And that's where I'll be doing my polar and advanced polar training.
Right, okay, got you.
Now, it's not the best month to do it in. Ideally, we want to do it in January, February time period where it's going to be completely dark, because you want to be training in the worst conditions, right?
Yeah.
So that when it comes to doing the actual expedition, whatever faces are thrown at you, you can deal with that. I did that in training. I know how to sort that problem. I know what that feels like. Unfortunately, because of COVID and the situation, we've had to change that to May time. So I'm going in May to do my polar training, and that's basically everything I did in core skills. So rope work, navigation, micro navigation, reading the land, advanced first aid at work, all of those things. I'll be doing those and add the cold into it, the minus temperatures when in Svalbard.
Yeah.
And then after I've completed that, I'll be doing the advanced polar training, which is just adding on to everything that we've learned during those polar trainings.
Okay.
And then after that, in January, we bring all of that together, all of everything that we've learned, all the knots, all the medical procedures, all the ways of navigating, all the ways of putting up your tent. Well, the one way of putting up your tent, which is the correct way, rather. in January, to go on a mini expedition, a training expedition, but an expedition in itself, around possibly Svalbard or wherever Jim and the instructors pick.
Yeah.
Counting polar bears, perhaps, or just basically implementing everything that we've learned throughout the year of training into an expedition-style trip to make sure that come the actual expedition, February, March time period, we are as well equipped and as well trained as we possibly can be mm-hmm. for going and supporting Jim on this crucial scientific expedition.
So how many of you are actually going in total, kind of the citizen scientists?
So there'll be 28 of us in total. So that's 7 per leg with Jim.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's all crazy people. I can't believe there's 28 people that are actually volunteering for this. So this sort of sounds quite expensive. How are you doing this alongside a degree? I'm guessing you're not working a full-time job on the side. How are you actually funding all of this?
No, actually, I don't actually have a job. My job is basically learning and, I guess, getting the money in for this. So that's a really, really good question, actually, because that wasn't asked the last time I did a podcast. And the some advice I'd give here is be determined, know what you're doing, set out to do it.
Yeah.
University, for me personally, is always a first, right? At the end of the day, I want my degree, and that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. If everything else gets a bit too much, just have a sit down and think, what is the really important things that you need to do? But coming away from that, how am I raising the money? Well, I need to raise £25,000. £12,000 goes to the Ice Warrior project, and that's a donation. Has to come from sponsors.
Right.
And the other £13,000, that basically pays for my training and my equipment, mm-hmm. which is a lot.
Yeah, it's not pocket money, is it?
No. And then, of course, you've got to pay for your accommodation, for your travel costs, and also your accommodation for where you're staying at university, plus your university fees, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of money to come with, and it can seem very daunting and very scary and very off-putting. And so can a placement, to be honest. So I'm going to link it to a placement, because that's more akin to what everyone else is doing. Yeah, so one of the main reasons when I speak to people and I say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do a placement. Are you going to do a placement as well? And they go, no. And I ask, oh, why? How can I help, etc.? And they go, oh, it's all because of funding. Funding seems to become the major thing.
Yeah.
And rightly so, right? You've got to live somehow.
People want some stability after uni.
Yeah, so I think, to put it quite frankly, we've all got to think, we're going to university, we're studying this degree, or whatever degree that might be. You know, it could be medicine or it could be law.
Yeah.
We're just happening to studying marine biology in one of its flavours. We are all going to come out of this in debt, unless you've paid for the whole thing yourself, of course. If you've got any student loans, we are going to come out in debt. And you've got to drive that home and think, okay, that's fine. That'll be gone in 30 years, or that'll be something I can pay off and what I've coped for. It's not a lot that they take out each time.
Yeah.
And just depending on your salary, if you're over minimum wage, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure you all know how that works. But obviously a placement is slightly different, right? Because you've got to fund it yourself, or maybe you're lucky enough to have a placement that gives you a bursary and that gives you a grant, and that's fantastic for you, and that's the dream, basically, that everyone
wants. They're very rare.
They are very rare, and they don't come about very often.
Especially marine biology.
So what I'm trying to say here, to speed the process up, is don't find a placement extremely daunting. The most daunting bit is finding a placement to actually go on, to find somewhere that you really want to go, and that is giving you the transferable skills, or even just the skills needed for your third year. For example, it might help you in a module, or it might help you with your future career for what you want to do, or it might open up your eyes to doing something new after you finish your degree.
Mm-hmm.
John Spicer said to the first years when they arrived, is marine biology isn't actually a degree. There's no such thing as marine biology.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there as a second year thinking, oh, well, what am I saying here? At least I'm doing the and oceanography. So that's only 50% of my degree. That's nothing. Tough luck for all those who are just doing marine biology. But what he really meant by that is that what we learn here is the analytics, it's the problem solving, it's those key transferable skills that can be used for whatever you want to do in the future. So for example, one of my good family friends, she used to study marine biology, she didn't finish her degree in the end, but she's now got a PhD, which isn't anything related to marine biology at all.
Okay, yeah.
But she used all her transferable skills that she learned from doing that degree and implemented them into her PhD that she was doing, and now into the work that she's doing.
Yeah.
I believe she works for the government now. But what John was trying to say, and what I'm trying to say, is that marine biology, or whatever degree you might be doing, is really sought after. So don't worry if you enter your degree thinking, oh, I really don't want to study this subject anymore, or, oh, I do, but where I want to go isn't quite what I've learnt in my degree. Well, you've all got those transferable skills, so you can all go and do that. But going back to the placement, don't let the money problem put you off, because I believe in every single one of you that you can actually achieve it and you can do it. It's all about having the determination to look, to find those bursaries that are out there, to speak to the university placement team, to know what you want to do, and then go about doing it. And I think you might have to sacrifice some weekends to do some Googling to find where you want to go and then to find how you're going to fund it. But trust me, it's really worthwhile when you finish your degree and you say you've done a placement and you've done all those fantastic things. So to point you in some directions, there is the Santander Scholarship, which is only for University of Plymouth students, and that grants up to £1,000 in that region, and it gives it to 20 students. So to be honest, you've not got too bad of an opportunity there. Yeah. Because it's only University of Plymouth students, so that only limits it down to your university, not the world.
Yeah.
You've got, if you're going travelling somewhere, for example, if you've got a placement, so I'm doing my training in Svalbard, I applied to the Marine Biology Association. That's a really another good one. If you're a member of the Marine Biology Association, you can apply for the grants and bursaries that they have going.
Okay, yeah.
One of them is the travel bursary. So I applied for the travel bursary for my expedition. I could have easily applied for it to do one of my other placements, should that have been abroad or somewhere else in the UK that I needed funding for travel. And hopefully after a good application process, they come back to you and say congratulations, as they did for me, and they'll award you, not all of it, but you know what they can towards your travel grant. There's other ones. So for example, look into where you're going. For example, I'm going to Sweden for university, and there's a bursary called the CoScan Application Award. Now, I didn't apply for that for that university. We applied for that because I'm going to Svalbard, and that's in Scandinavia. I don't hear back from them till later, but again, there's another travel grant bursary for you. So think where you're going in the world and think, is there any specific travel grants to get there, rather than just the generic ones? Because again, you're limiting it down from anyone in the globe that can go and get this grant to just those that are wanting to go to that area.
Yeah, that's so really that's good advice, actually, because they don't really talk about that too much, I don't think. The grant side of things, I always see grants as something kind of unobtainable that only kind of the top people get, but you're making it sound like you do have a shot if you give it a go and it you try hard enough.
Yeah, it sounds scary. It is a bit of a daunting process. There's some really tough grants out there, and there's some that are doable and accessible. Some you need references for, some you don't need references for. For example, the CoScan one you don't need references for, but the Santander Scholarship you do need a reference for. Again, in terms of think about what you're actually doing, where you're going, what societies are you a part of, because then they can offer grants. The Andrukov Memorial Fund, for example, specifically related to the polar regions, there's another good grant to go for. If you're trying to think, oh, where do I find all these grants? Where do I go to do that? The Royal Geographic Society has an entire website with, I don't know, countless pages on it, pointing you to specific grants for certain things in whatever field you might be in, some obviously relating to geography because it's the Royal Geographic Society. But that's where I found the CoScan application grant. So there are a multitude of grants out there, and you've just got to know where to look. So get Googling, get looking at the Royal Geographic Society. And of course, let's not forget about the Turing Fund or Erasmus, which the University of Plymouth offers, Student Finance England as well. You know, these are all places that you can go and get grants. If you're doing something a little bit extra and out of the ordinary, for example, my expedition, you can also apply for corporate sponsorship or something else, as long as, you know, you tailor it towards them. So for example, I'm going on my expedition. The BBC North East, for example, are wanting to interview me when I come back in May. So there's a selling point. Would you like your company logo on my equipment, on my PR equipment, for when I go and do interviews such as with the BBC or other type of things? And they might say, yes, here's a fund towards that. So, okay, maybe you might not be going on those extremely big expeditions like I am, but just think there's also other ways out there. It doesn't have to come from grants. It doesn't have to come from the university, right? If you can think of other ways to make money, that might just be working a part-time shift or something. It's always doable, but keep an eye out there, and I believe you can do it in the end. It just takes a few weekends of your time, but it is possible. It is obtainable. I'm trying to get there. If I can do it, so can you, type mentality.
I love it. And that's really good advice for people out there that are considering placements or some crazy hypothetical expedition to the Arctic, those people as well. So what are your plans post sort of Arctic expedition and degree? Have you got an idea? Because it's quite hard to know at this point, I think.
Well, I've always wanted to work for the British Antarctic Survey.
Ooh.
That's something I've always wanted to do as the resident marine biologist, and so I'm kind of trying to go through all those steps to get there. I spoke to Dr. Kieran Fraser, who's worked for the British Antarctic Survey for 10 years. He's done the interviewing process. He is the one who is the head of the marine station, who does the scientific diving module and the HSE course.
The person to know, then.
The person to know, I guess, for that world within the university. And so he's been really helpful with giving tips and tricks as to what to do. And I said, Kieran, I want to become the resident marine biologist in the British Antarctic Survey. How do I do that? I'm a diver. This is what I do. This is what I'm interested in. And he basically says, get a first. So no pressure.
Easy, piece of cake.
Yeah, I can do that, Kieran. Don't worry about it. And the other thing is make sure you've got lots of experience with cold water dives. And that when you go on a placement, make sure it's not one that you've paid to go on. Because although that's good, and you've saved the turtles, or done whatever, that's in warm water. Not obviously trying to put that down or anything, that's absolutely fantastic. I'm not saying don't do that, go ahead and do that. If that's your thing, if conservation's your thing, go and do that, that's extremely good for you. But in terms of the British Antarctic Survey, they want something cold-based. It's really competitive, so they really want you to have something that you've really gone out of your way to get, and that you've really researched, and that it's not something you've paid to then go and have that experience for, basically, is what he's saying. So, again, my expedition is really helpful for that. Again, the HSE course is really helpful for that. Again, the scientific diving module is really good for that. Yeah. A placement year is really good to get that experience needed, because you can only get so much in a summer towards getting the additional qualifications needed to stand a chance in applying at BAS, the British Antarctic Survey.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm currently going through at the moment. I believe that is what Faith is also trying to go through at the moment as well.
Shout out to Faith. That's amazing, because in a way you're kind of lucky, because you know what your end goal is. You can then tailor everything you do towards that application. It's a bit harder when people don't know what they want to do ultimately.
I was very much like that before as well. Okay. In terms of what degree, I didn't know what degree I wanted to do at the time. That wasn't until later I decided I wanted to do marine biology, and then I did a summer work experience type thing at Newcastle University at the Dove Marine Station, and that's where I really thought, oh yeah, marine biology, and actually at that point oceanography is something that I really want to study, and so hence why I'm here today.
Yeah.
In terms of, oh, I don't actually know what career I want to do in the future, that's completely fine. We're in second year, we're an undergrad, we're still learning everything. I don't think we should be worrying at this point as to, oh, what safe and secure job should we have when we finish our degree? Do I want to do a master's? Can I go straight to a PhD? What job should I need to have? All questions that need to be there need to be answered. But I wouldn't be fixated and really worried on, when I finish my degree, what on earth am I going to do afterwards? I think that will come in time, and a spark will ignite, and all of a sudden you'll go, I really like this. And of course it doesn't have to. You know, you've got all those skills there. You might decide, I was thinking about it myself when I finished my degree, following my mum's footsteps, although she did this before her degree, is go travelling for a bit. I've got my degree, I'll go out there, I'll explore the world a bit, do a little bit of marine biology along the way.
Yeah, to see where you end up.
And see where you end up. Of course, that was before I decided I want to work for the British Antarctic Survey, and so I've got more of a regimented process of how I want to do that. But if you're sitting and listening to this thinking, I really have no idea what I want to do, master students, PhD students are probably sitting there thinking the same thing as well. What is it that I'm going to do after this? And just go with it. Go with what you like doing, and you'll never make the wrong decision, is how I see it.
No, that's a good mindset. To be fair, we have all made it to this point from just kind of seeing where we went. So that's kind
Don't
of
forget,
reassuring.
You've come through the world of COVID. We didn't do A-levels. We came straight to university.
Speak for yourself. I did them, and they were awful. Awful things.
Well, for example, my year didn't do A-levels. They were given to us by the government, for better or for worse, that's your own opinion. And we didn't do first year of university. That was all on Zoom. You know, we weren't in the classes. We didn't do all the practicals that we should have done. So, you know, we have gone through quite a lot. And it's okay to think, I was only really surviving through that process. I wasn't really having a mindset of, this is where I want to be at the end. And that's applicable to everyone. Everyone, it doesn't matter how accomplished you are. I've gone through that period of their life, and we're all the same in that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I was just surviving. I was trying to get through that. And now we've come out the end, hopefully, now I can start thinking about getting myself to the point at which I'm more confident and capable of getting to my end goal, whatever that might be, or finding that end goal.
That's a really key point. Like, I know that throughout COVID and everything, you ended up going to an online thing and then ending up on the expedition. But to be fair, the point is not to feel bad for if you didn't do anything. Because apart from that, you were saying you just did normal things, really, just surviving. I feel like we're all making up for a bit of lost time now. I'm trying to catch up any bit of lab experience I can get. I'm trying to lap it up.
That's a good point as well. You know, your lecturers are out there. If you're really passionate about doing something and you can't go on a placement for whatever reason that might be, you know, financially or otherwise, then you've also got the summer there. But you've also got during term time as well. Your tables are not always full, you know. You don't have a lecture every single day. Wednesday afternoons are off. If you're not someone who does loads of sport, but you like going for long walks and stuff, maybe you could ask one of your lecturers who you're interested in within their field, can I come along to whatever you're doing and help you out investigating this, or helping a PhD student with whatever they're doing to get some lab experience and to be able to talk to someone who maybe has gone through your process of what you're going through, has done your degree, and is able to offer some help and advice that perhaps your peers, your parents, your friends might not be able to because they've been in your situation or have done the same degree as you. And you might find that really helpful and really useful. And of course, it'll look good in your CV as well because you'll be able to put it down on there. And it might give you some more skills and help you with your coursework or whatever it might be that you're doing related to your module. And it'll open some doors later down the line as well.
Contacts,
exactly.
Word of mouth is everything. Just speaking to people. Most opportunities come from speaking to people, I always find, personally. Yeah. A conversation, simple as that. Yeah, thank you very much, Matt, for coming on, and I wish you the best with the expedition. I hope that it all goes well and you enjoy it and you come back safe and sound to come and speak to us on the podcast again. But just to wrap everything up, I want to end with Creature of the Week. Everyone, Creature of the Week, are you excited,
Yay!
Matt?
This is a surprise.
A bit scared
I didn't know this was happening.
Right, so I'll explain how it works. I'm just going to read through some clues of the organism I'm talking about, and if at any point you think you know it, you just tell me what you think it is. It's simple as that.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
We'll see.
So let's see. So the first clue, we're talking about a marine mammal.
Okay.
Do you know what it is yet?
A marine mammal.
Yeah. a cetacean.
Uh-huh. A dolphin. Do you want the scientific name for it?
No, we're not going that far. Okay. No, it's okay. We'll play nice. They are pregnant for 14 to 16 months. I'm not expecting you to.
Oh, that's a big clue, unfortunately.
Yeah, sorry. they don't migrate away from the region they reside in.
Okay.
They are predated upon by polar bears and orcas. They have...
It's predated upon by... Polar bears, and was that it, was it?
And orcas.
Orcas. And it's in the polar regions.
Yeah. They don't move away from there.
And they don't move away.
As far as I'm aware. So next clue, they have a single long tusk, and it's most commonly found on the males.
Yes. That would be a... It's not a narwhal, is it?
Yay!
Oh!
My last clue was it rhymes with barbel. Narwhal. So I'm glad that you got it before that. Well done, Matt. That was amazing. Thanks very much.
We got to the last clue and I was just getting it. I'm sure loads of people got that way before I did. You don't have to be really smart to go to the Arctic. In fact, maybe you're about crazy and stupid to do that.
This is true. I mean, you said it yourself. I didn't have to say anything. Thanks very much, Matt, and good luck. And please, please, please come and fill us in after the expedition.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi everyone, I hope you enjoyed the episode with Matt and myself talking about all things placements, funding, the degree, and also his life-changing expedition to the Northern Pole of inaccessibility. I wish Matt all the luck in the world for that, and hopefully we'll hear back from him later on in the season. All of Matt's social media pages will be in the description below, so go and give him a follow to keep up to date with his expedition and his fundraising. He also has a GoFundMe page, so if you can donate at all, I'm sure Matt and his team will be very appreciative of that. But in the meantime, stay curious, ask questions, get outside as much as you can, and fully immerse yourself in the amazing marine life that we have here in Plymouth.